a rare glimpse inside the hermit kingdom on the world. I'm Marco Werman. North Korea keeps Western journalists allowed into the country on a very tight leash. Authorities control everything they see. But we found a reporter currently in Pyongyang, and she says the trip is worth it because you can catch some telling details about daily life there.
You see just how antiquated things remain, you know, that you still see oxen plowing fields. You see people with scissors cutting the grass.
Also, Rio's image is in tatters just months before the Olympics get underway there. And a judge in Mexico approves the extradition of drug cartel boss El Chapo Guzman. Maybe.
Right now it is a race between extradition and escape.
That and more coming up today here on The World. Glad you could be with us. We start today with the image problem some countries have. Carefree days at the beach and samba might be shorthand for Brazil, but it hardly captures the reality there at the moment. We'll have more on that in a couple of minutes. As for North Korea, well, where to start? This is a place, after all, that embraced Dennis Rodman in the name of diplomacy. And there are reports that North Koreans go hungry in the countryside, while elites in Pyongyang drink French cognac. Comic or tragic, those are some pretty big image problems. And right now, there are about 100 foreign journalists in North Korea. They were invited to observe the rare gathering of the People's Party Congress. Make that 100 minus 1. My BBC colleague Rupert Wingfield Hayes is relieved to be out now after being detained and questioned for 8 hours by North Korean authorities. A government spokesman there said Wingfield Hayes spoke ill of the North Korean leadership.
We have decided to expel a Tokyo BBC correspondent, Rupert Wingfield Hayes, from the territory of the DPRK, and we are going to never admit him again into the country for any report.
When foreign journalists in Pyongyang heard the news, it sent a chill through the press room at the hotel.
We're all very conscious of the fact that this is an unpredictable situation and that this is a regime that has a habit of detaining people. Having said that, I haven't been pulling my punches in terms of what I write and what I tweet.
That's Anna Fifield of The Washington Post. She told me that foreign journalists reporting on the big party Congress have been kept on a tight leash.
We are completely following the government schedule here. They decide what we do, where we go. We have a state-appointed minder with us at all times to keep an eye on us, take notes on us, to, you know, stop us from going places or asking too many questions. As my own minder told me this week, he said, "I don't like working with you. You ask too many questions."
So what about the Workers' Party Congress, the reason all of these journalists from out of town went to North Korea? Were you able to actually see any of it?
I was able to see the outside of the building, which was as close as we got. 130 journalists had been brought here for the Congress specifically. On the day that it opened, we were taken to the street corner about 500 yards away from the building where the Congress was taking place. And then for the rest of the period that the Congress has been going, 4 days, you know, we have been doing the rounds of electric cable factories. Today we went to a silk mill. We've been to a farm. We've been everywhere but to the Congress. So it's very frustrating to be here, to be covering this once in a generation event in North Korea. And we've been reduced to watching it on the TV screen here as we could have done from anywhere else. But having said that, I do always think that it is worth coming to North Korea, even given all the restrictions, because we do manage to have a glimpse into what is taking place in the capital city, and only in the capital city, but we can still pick up some clues about what's going on in North Korea.
Yeah, so tell me about those glimpses and what clues you're seeing. Like, I mean, considering this is highly scripted political theater, any surprises?
No surprises yet. I think, I mean, the thing that strikes me most of all, I have been coming here for 11 years, is the changes that we've seen in Pyongyang. This city actually looks quite good these days. The quality of living for people who live here, and this is just the elite, this is the top maybe 5 or 10% of North Korea who get to live here, but their quality of life has improved a lot. We now see kind of fancy restaurants, people with a lot more disposable income here. So if you are one of the lucky, loyal elite who live in Pyongyang, your life has gotten quite a lot better.
And what about the last time you went outside Pyongyang? I don't know if you managed to do that on this visit, but what do we see outside the capital that you just would not find inside the city?
Right. I haven't been outside the capital on this visit, but in these journeys, you know, we went to a farm on the outskirts of Pyongyang and we came in from the airport. And in my last visit here in 2014, you see just how antiquated things remain. You know, that you still see oxen plowing fields. You still see people, with scissors cutting the grass.
So scissors it's still cutting the grass.
Those kind of shears, like scissory shears, they're doing it by hand. It's incredible. It's like going back to the, I don't know, before the Industrial Revolution sometimes. It's unusual to see heavy machinery outside of the city. And if you do, it seems like it's come out of 1950s Soviet Union.
Anna Fifield, the Tokyo-based correspondent for The Washington Post, speaking with us from Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. Thank you very much, Anna.
Thanks for having me on, Marco.
Here's another story about a place with an image problem right now. Brazil, samba and sensuality, a sunny, fun-loving place, a host this summer's Olympic Games, right? Well, yeah, except for Zika, a failing economy, a corruption scandal that keeps getting worse. Don't forget the politics. They can't get much wackier. Brazil's president Dilma Rousseff continues to face imminent impeachment. Today, though, the acting speaker of Brazil's lower house of Congress annulled last month's impeachment vote. So Brazil's image right now, samba, sun, and sensuality, cover it about as well as a string bikini. From Rio, here's the world's Will Carlos.
Workers in Rio de Janeiro scramble to complete the last few hundred meters of an iconic new bike path. It's a stunning sight, with the path suspended in parts alongside cliffs above the Atlantic. This was supposed to be one of the jewels in the crown of Rio's metamorphosis into an Olympic city. Then, last month, a big wave hit one of the most picturesque sections of the path, destroying it instantly. Two people died, and at a press conference shortly afterwards, Rio's mayor, Eduardo Paes, apologized for the tragedy. He said, this isn't really an Olympic project, but it's a very symbolic project for this moment in the transformation of this city. Paes reassured the public that Rio's Olympic venues will be ready and that the city's infamous traffic jams will be eased by a new metro line. But for many cariocas, as Rio's residents are called, it was precisely the collapse of the flashy, poorly engineered pet project that truly symbolizes Rio's current state. Like the country as a whole, Rio faces multiple deep-rooted crises that, despite political bravado, have already given the city a big image problem.
A cidade não está preparada, a cidade não tem saúde e educação para seus próprios habitantes.
This city isn't prepared. The city doesn't have health care or education for its residents. Even worse is public safety. I don't think we're prepared at all for this.
That's a lifeguard who works in Barra da Tijuca, the main Olympic neighborhood. We'll call him João Pessoa. He asked us not to use his real name, since talking to us could cost him his job or even land him in jail. João told me the state of Rio de Janeiro is broke and that lifeguards receive their pay weeks late and not always in full. Same goes for police officers, teachers, doctors and firefighters across the state. Hundreds of thousands of them recently went on strike, shutting down hospitals, schools and fire stations. Apart from the state's economic woes, Rio has long had a reputation for crime and violence, something that officials here have been trying to counter for decades. A program called Pacification sought to drive crime out of Rio's marginalized favelas by invading them with battalions of military police. That's helped drive down some violent crime, but it's also had another effect, increasing the number of shootings by police in the very favelas they're supposed to be protecting. And in the run-up to the Olympics, that's only worsening, said Teresa Williamson, who runs Catalytic Communities, a local non-profit that advocates for favela residents.
You've got these police officers that really aren't prepared, that are underpaid, and that have been trained to be violent, and that are now even more trigger-happy than in the past because of the Olympics and the pressure that Rio is facing to be a safe place during the Games.
Which brings us back to Rio's ill-fated bicycle path. After part of the path collapsed last month, investigators revealed it just hadn't been designed to withstand the impact of a wave. But of course, big waves routinely batter that cycle path and the road it's next to. So the path looked great, but it was fundamentally, structurally unsound. At its core, that's the problem. Rio's Olympic Village will probably look fantastic. The city will likely gleam and the venues will sparkle during the games in August. But once the athletes have left, Rio and its residents will be left with the serious problems they've been facing all along. For the world, Will Carlos, Rio de Janeiro.
And speaking of image problems, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman is considered one of the most violent heads of any drug cartel in Mexico. Guzman's currently behind bars again in a Mexican prison. But today, a judge in Mexico ruled that El Chapo can be extradited to the U.S. to face trafficking charges. Alejandro Hope is security and justice editor at eldailypost.com in Mexico City. And I asked him whether Mexicans think this latest news about El Chapo is good or bad.
Well, it's certainly good news. It will be better news when extradition actually happens. And that's still not in the immediate future. What a federal judge did was offer a non-binding ruling that El Chapo can be legally extradited to the U.S. But that means that now the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has to meet a number of requirements before that actually happens, and Chapo's defense team still has a number of legal instruments at their disposal to block this.
This ruling from the judge comes the day after El Chapo was moved to a prison that's closer to the U.S. border, a high-security prison in the northern city of Ciudad Juarez. Why was that move taken?
Well, no one knows for sure. There's the possibility that the authorities had planned this type of transfers for El Chapo all along, so as to destabilize any potential attempts at escape, so as to make it harder for him to rebuild the conditions that allowed him to escape from prison a year ago. Another similar possibility is that the authorities are really paranoid. They got really scared. There was an electrical malfunction at the Altiplano prison a couple of days ago, and they thought that might be a signal that something might be going on, and they decided to transfer him. And finally, they might have, and this is not very likely, but it's certainly not impossible, they might have discovered actual escape plans from El Chapo, and they decided to preempt that risk by transferring him to a different prison.
Well, we have seen successful escapes by El Chapo in the past. He also seems to have friends in all sorts of places. How likely, in your judgment, is it that he will be eventually extradited to the U.S.?
It all depends on the time frame. Right now, it is a race between extradition and escape. If he's given enough time in a Mexican prison, he will certainly attempt to break from jail again. So the whole question hinges on how fast can extradition happen. My guess is probably not for another year at the earliest.
Yeah. So is that fast enough?
We'll see. Yeah, that's something that is very hard to predict.
Alejandro Hope, security and justice editor at eldailypost.com in Mexico City. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Coming up, migrants find an unlikely place to stay in Athens that's still ahead here on The World.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs for answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the latest in emerging markets to finding the next big computing platform. Tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
London's got a new mayor.
My name is Sadiq Khan and I'm the mayor of London.
Sadiq Khan is the son of Pakistani immigrants and he's the first Muslim to hold the post of mayor in London. Qari Asim is senior imam at a mosque in the English city of Leeds, and he told me that Khan's win feels momentous.
It has an enormous personal and political impact on me. It has strengthened my understanding of the British culture and how, you know, there are so many opportunities for us to succeed. The mayoral campaign was dominated by smears on religion and ethnicity. The first Muslim to lead a major Western city, Sadiq Khan's landslide victory, is all the more important because it is not only, you know, important for British Muslims, but he is a mayor of all Londoners.
What does the failure of that smear campaign, the fact that he was elected, what does that suggest to you?
I think it suggests that effectively the Brits and the whole, you know, Western world doesn't believe in hatred. You know, that there are fringes on both sides, you know, whether you want to call them Islamist extremists or, you know, the far right. They like to create and plant seeds of division and prejudice and hatred. But the fact that Sadiq Khan has won this mayor election and having received more than 1.3 million votes, you know, suggests that people got no time for hatred.
You wrote this essay in the Yorkshire Evening Post, and you wrote, the extremists want European Muslims to hate the West, but Sadiq Khan is the West, so are the 3 million Muslims living in Britain. Can you just elaborate a little more on what you mean by that?
Sure. So the fact that Sadiq Khan has won makes two points, very pertinent points. So firstly, it defeats the narrative that far right want to play, that effectively Muslims cannot be trusted to lead communities and societies. And secondly, the extremists, the likes of ISIS and Boko Haram, they are trying to promote this clash of civilization, effectively alluring young Muslims to migrate from the West to war zone areas like Syria and Iraq or parts of Africa. But this mayoral election suggests that Muslims are part and parcel of this society. So when you know, a sympathizer with extremists is saying the Muslims should leave Britain and hate British people, effectively we are hating ourselves. You know, we are Brits and Britain is our home.
Of course, there's been a lot made about Sadiq Khan and his background, his father from Pakistan, a Pakistani bus driver, grew up in public housing. What about your own story? Is there something in the Sadiq Khan story that you can personally relate to?
So Sadiq Khan's victory is symbolic and significant for me on a personal as well as political level, because my father also came from Pakistan and he came to this country because of the opportunities that this country offered. And I'm really grateful to Britain, the fact that I'm the only imam in the country who leads daily prayers, but also I work in a global law firm and also work with so many people of different faiths and different communities to build bridges and bring communities together. So from that point of view, I can relate so much to what Sadiq Khan has been saying. And I think our personal stories are very similar, albeit he's working in a political world and I'm working in a spiritual world.
Qari Asim, senior imam at the Makkah Mosque in Leeds in the UK. Imam Asim, thanks very much for your time today.
Great, thank you.
A check-in now on a story we've been following for more than a year, Europe's migrant crisis. The problems are especially bad in Greece, where tens of thousands of migrants are stuck in crowded camps. And it's gotten worse recently. In March, Macedonia slammed shut its border with Greece, stranding even more migrants trying to get through the Balkans. But some 300 of those weary travelers have had a stroke of luck. Greek activists liberated the three-star City Plaza Hotel for them in the center of Athens.
They just took over this building that had been sitting there unoccupied for 7 years.
That's correspondent Jean Carstensen. She's in Athens following the refugee crisis with support from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting.
Activists here in Athens decided to occupy the hotel. They opened the doors and now have opened it to refugees.
We call radio the theater of the mind. So before we go on, let's just hear a few seconds of the sound of the hallways at that hotel. It's kind of evocative.
It feels actually like a three-star hotel, a very bright atmosphere. But then you notice it's more like a bustling camp. There are kids running everywhere, and there are refugees from at least six countries occupying all rooms, having their meals there. They're making the place run. They have committees to clean up. They have committees to cook three meals a day. They've got childcare committees going. The refugees can come and go as they like. They're given a key to a room. And for them, this is a tremendous luxury. And they're right there in the center of Athens.
I'd like our listeners to hear from one of those refugees you met who left one of the big refugee camps in Greece and is now living in this former hotel. Here's a soft-spoken man named Ali Jafari from Kandahar in Afghanistan.
And now It's 100 times better than the camp. The food, the place, it's all clean. In the condition we were in the camp, it was like we were just like animals.
Yeah, 100 times better than the camp. I mean, these asylum seekers are at this hotel in part because of Greek activists who are trying to get refugees better housing. I'd like us to hear from one of those activists. Here's a man named Nassim Lomani. He's with the group Solidarity to Refugees, the group that actually helped to take over the City Plaza Hotel. Nassim himself came to Greece as a refugee from Afghanistan more than 10 years ago. Here's Nassim.
We want to create a bridge and a relation with the people around us, that people stay in more human condition than to stay outside of houses, their doors, sleeping.
Jean, what these activists, people like Nassim Lomani, what they're doing, it's not legal, is it?
No, it's entirely illegal. They just took over this building, had been sitting there unoccupied for 7 years. They expected the police might come and evict them, but they have not done that. According to these activists, there are about 4,000 buildings that are unoccupied around Athens. And they see the City Plaza Hotel as an example. They want Greek officials to think about creative ways to use these unoccupied buildings. They know that what they're doing is not going to solve the refugee crisis, but they're determined to show that people can live together in the center of Athens, refugees and Greeks.
Are the refugees themselves getting any pushback from Greeks? Because Greece is going through this deep economic crisis. I imagine some people are thinking, hey, I want to live in a three-star hotel.
Some people around the hotel are disgruntled. There's a lot of economic distress going on in Greece right now. But there are a lot of Greek activists and others who are involved in this effort to support refugees at this hotel and in other areas of society. So there are tensions, but for now, at least with the City Plaza Hotel, there seems to be more support than antagonism.
And what about the owners of the hotel? Are they upset or are they participating in this housing project willingly?
No, the owner is very upset. And in fact, there's a hashtag regarding this issue, and she is trying to get support. But again, there's nothing she can do at this point.
Jean Carstensen in Athens, thanks so much. We're looking forward to hearing more of your reports.
Thanks, Marco.
You can see what life is like for those migrants at the City Plaza Hotel in Athens. Just head over to PRI.org. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. A new program is organizing free trips to Cuba for young Cuban Americans so they can explore their heritage without all the baggage.
This gave me the opportunity to just kind of take politics out of the equation and just talk to people on a human level.
Plus, a place where lightning strikes 100,000 times a year. That's all ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We are a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. November is still 6 months away, but the deadline to turn green card holders into Americans, Americans able to vote, is just around the corner. Nearly 9 million U.S. residents are eligible to become citizens. Historically, most don't bother going for full-on naturalization, but this year the trend is changing. The World's Jason Margolis has reported on citizenship drives in past elections. We sent him to Nevada to see what's going on this time.
On a Saturday morning at a Las Vegas high school, more than 500 immigrants, mostly Latino, line up to begin the citizenship process. Some arrive hours early to make sure they get a spot inside.
188, 188.
This is one of a handful of nonpartisan events held this spring in Vegas, this one run by the Culinary Workers Union, Local 226. It hopes to create 2,000 new Americans this year. Easier said than done. Applicants have to brush up on their English, U.S. history, and civics to pass an exam. There's also a $680 fee, though that's waived for low-income applicants. And many immigration lawyers charge hefty legal fees to navigate the process. An event like this can save hopeful Americans thousands of dollars and a lot of time, thanks to free legal advice and volunteer help filling out the citizenship applications.
Any removal or deportation proceedings currently pending against you?
Ever been a member or associated with Communist Party?
About 4 years ago, I came to Las Vegas and did almost this exact same story you're now hearing. I met many of the same people you're about to hear from, including John Tooman, head of the Political Science Department at UNLV. 2012 was a slow year to register citizens, but 2008 wasn't. Slightly more than a million people took the oath of citizenship nationwide then, a big number even for an election year.
When we were coming into the 2008 electoral cycle, immigration was fresh in everyone's minds, and I think that was an important factor that was motivating individuals and groups to become naturalized citizens.
This year, immigration advocates are hoping to sign up a million new voters again. The numbers are still rolling in. Anecdotally, in Nevada, Tooman says he's seeing a strong wave of immigrants wanting to vote this year.
This time around, they're also talking about perceived bias and discrimination against Latinos as one of the top issues.
How does perceived bias and discrimination translate? At the Citizenship Fair in Vegas, I asked people why they were here.
Trump.
Yeah, I do want to vote against Trump. I don't support him.
No big surprise there. What did surprise me is just how much of a motivator Trump has become. I had a lot of conversations like this.
Oliver Markin.
Where are you from, Oliver?
Guatemala.
Guatemala, okay. How long have you been in the United States?
24 years.
24 years. How long have you been eligible to become a citizen?
Since I got here.
His wife, Virginia, by his side, corrects him. Technically, he's been eligible for citizenship for only 19 years. Still, he sat on the sidelines for a lot of elections. I met other people who had been eligible to become citizens for 50 years. I asked Marroquin why he's getting off the bench this year. Virginia answers for him.
Tell him how you feel about Trump.
He doesn't want Trump to win. He's very adamant that he does not want him in.
Is she speaking correctly for you?
Yes.
Okay.
That is correct.
Now, it's one thing to be motivated by a negative. It's another thing entirely to be drawn to the voting booth by a positive, an alluring candidate. Fernando Romero doesn't see that this year for Latinos. Romero is president of Hispanics in Politics, Nevada's oldest Latino political organization. He was a Democrat for 48 years, no longer.
And I changed parties to Republican 9 months ago because of Hillary Clinton. Because Hillary Clinton had asked that the children, the refugee children from Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, be deported without the proper hearings per the law. She also fought against undocumented immigrants having a driver's permit.
Romero's list goes on and on. To be clear, Romero despises Trump.
Mr. Trump has offended everybody.
But when Romero hears Clinton now acting as a champion for the rights of immigrants or Central American child migrants, it disgusts him.
Mrs. Clinton has been able to pull the wool over a lot of Latinos' eyes and say, I love you and I want you and you vote for me, and many of them are. Many of us are not.
So what are you going to do? Are you going to vote?
I honestly don't know. Probably sit on my hands.
Others may follow Romero's tactic, but it's unlikely that new U.S. citizens will sit this one out. If this is your first chance to vote for a U.S. president, even if you don't love your choices, you're still going to vote. And then there's this fact. Nearly 3 million residents eligible for U.S. citizenship come from Mexico. If you're Donald Trump, that just can't be a welcome number. For The World, Jason Margolis, Las Vegas.
Jason mentioned concerns over the fate of tens of thousands of young migrants that came from Central America. Many are now awaiting immigration hearings. And while U.S. authorities decide whether they stay or go back to the countries they fled, school-age kids are entitled to continue their education. It is federal law, but it's being enforced unevenly across the country. Garance Burke is the national investigative reporter for the Associated Press. She covered this story with her colleague Adrian Sands. Now, you found that some migrant children, Garance, are welcomed into schools, others are not. Where are the success stories, first of all, and how is the system supposed to work?
We found many success stories in districts across the country where school districts have done extraordinary things to welcome migrant youth into existing ESL programs or have hired new staff, sought foundation funding to create new programs to help these youth integrate into the U.S. school system. One example is here in San Francisco, where I'm based, where there's Newcomer High School, where migrant youth can receive on-campus counseling, legal support, and other services to help them stay in school as they're awaiting their immigration court hearing.
Right, so a variety of things. Education continues, educational assessment, there's counseling, ESL classes. Now, you write about a young man in Memphis who grew up in Guatemala. Tell us about Candelario Jimón Alonso.
So Candelario Jimón Alonso is one of the migrants who was sent to Memphis. He came from the highlands of Guatemala. He speaks an indigenous language as his first language, the language Quiché, and learned Spanish while he was growing up too, but had no familiarity with English and had really hoped to learn English and math when he arrived here, escaping a difficult situation in Guatemala. Instead, his school district routed him outside the mainstream high school to an adult school where he would have been able to take English for a few hours every week, only then the state of Tennessee shut down that ESL program, leaving Candelario and at least a dozen other minors with essentially no school option.
How common a story is that?
We found many examples of similar situations where migrant youth were routed to adult schools, which attorneys and advocates argue is basically, you know, a separate but unequal program, if you will, essentially an academic dead end that in some cases may break federal law.
I mean, it would seem that access to English as a second language class is a kind of crucial first step for these kids. Is lack of English often where the system starts to fail these kids?
Sometimes school districts who lack experience with English language learners also don't understand how to enroll children who don't have the paperwork that districts typically ask for when parents show up to enroll their kids, which would be, you know, utility bills, birth certificates, government-issued identification. But unaccompanied minors from Central America, of course, have migrated here by themselves. They are, you know, kids or teens. And so they may not have that paperwork and they may not also have a sponsor who is their legal guardian. So some of the troubles can begin even before enrolling.
How many kids are being affected by this and not getting access to education? Did you come away from your investigation with a big number?
So the AP analyzed some of the federal data about where children have been placed across the country to try to pinpoint areas where the number of migrant children was relatively large when compared to public school enrollment, to try to get a sense of where the trouble spots might be. And we found that in at least 35 districts in 14 states, minors have been discouraged from enrolling in schools or pressured into what advocates against are these unequal alternative programs.
AP National Investigative Reporter Garance Burke telling us about why migrant children have been kept from enrolling in school. Thanks very much, Garance.
Thanks so much for having me, Marco.
Take from the rich, give to the poor. A noble concept, but just practically, very hard to do in a city like Karachi, Pakistan's largest metropolitan area with more than 20 million people. Each night, many of those people go to bed hungry. They're so poor. But that's not deterring a group of friends in Karachi that's trying to help. Our BBC colleague Shaima Khalil went to meet the Robin Hood Army.
In one of Karachi's affluent neighborhoods, not far from the city's coast, families have gathered for Sunday lunch in a high-end restaurant. The menu offers everything from the hungry man's burger to blue cheese steak and fantastic French toast. I'm with a group of young volunteers who've been collecting surplus food from some of the city's top restaurants all afternoon. They'll then distribute it among people in poor neighborhoods. They've been doing this every Sunday for more than a year now. Sara Afridi is the founder of the initiative named the Robin Hood Army. Before we head out to one of the slums, she stops to pick up a few more boxes.
So this is Panamore, and they actually give us a lot of these sweets that have fantastic cupcakes.
Not anything that people that you distribute to would have access to normally.
For sure, no. No, so because every cupcake, I think, is over 300 rupees, right? And these people have a full meal in less than one-sixth or one-third of that.
And so each one is 300 rupees is what, $3?
Round about, yeah. Or more, actually.
The picture changes rapidly as we reach a large slum in the heart of Karachi. The wide paved streets with high-fenced villas, seaside apartment blocks, and massive shopping malls give way to makeshift homes built on dirt roads surrounded by heaps of rubbish, with open sewers cutting through the area. This is the other side of Karachi, and you don't have to travel far to see the gap between the rich and poor here. As volunteers unload the food and get it ready for distribution, Sara tells me more about the idea of the Robin Hood Army.
How it really started was that my friend in India who started the Robin Hood Army really in India reached out to me because the demographics of Pakistan and India are so similar. And really our cause is twofold. So what we want to do is we want to stop food wastage and we want to have no person who goes to sleep hungry. And what was amazing was that we actually had restaurant owners reach out to us, which was really great. And, you know, they were really excited about this. They said there's so much food that goes to waste and this would be incredible.
Tell me what some of the challenges are doing this, because we're in quite a rough area. We are in the center of Karachi, but it's still very rough. Is security one of the challenges?
One of the biggest concerns, obviously, is security. I mean, in all the places we've ever gone to, we haven't faced the issue, but that's also because the way we shortlist places is, you know, we try to stray away from places we know there would be a possible security issue, for example.
Now that you've done this, does it bring home more the big contrast between the two sides of Karachi, the rich and poor?
Oh, it totally does, because you're stuck in your own bubble, and I'm sure you saw it, right? Like, I know people have this view of Pakistan and what it is and stuff, but people here are perfectly normal. They live in their own bubble, and you meet your friends, you dine out at high-end restaurants, you all you care about is, you know, brands and money, and then you come here, you meet people from a different background. It's really great to see them happy when you give them food, but it's more than that. It's that connection you have with these people and them remembering you. Just give two pieces of bread, yeah, because we don't have.
And what looks more like a tent than a house, Kulsum and 19 other family members wait patiently for the food to arrive. With so many people to feed, this meal makes so much difference.
She cleans houses for people.
And do you mind telling me how much you make a week or a month?
A little less than $150 a month.
A month. How has the Robin Hood Army helped you?
So she's saying that they don't have to cook food for a day, then it saves them money for like one day. But she says because they don't have the refrigerator, the food goes bad. They can't store the food, so it goes bad if they don't eat it immediately.
There are millions of people like Kulsum in Karachi. For the Robin Hood Army, their work is a small step in a movement they hope will spread across Pakistan.
The BBC's Shaima Khalil there, reporting from Karachi. Coming up, there's a place where lightning not only strikes twice, but 100,000 times a year. We'll take you there in a few minutes, here on The World. I traveled to Cuba in 2004. With a journalist visa, I flew legally from Miami and landed in Havana 45 minutes later. So it's strange to think that for many years now, it's been easier for me to get to the island than for Cuban Americans. For many of them, the island is just the stuff of memories. But there are efforts to change that, and helping out is a group of four young professionals in the Miami area. They created the Cuba One Foundation. It's modeled on the Birthright trips to Israel. The idea? Offer free trips to the island for young Cuban Americans so that they can explore their heritage. The trips are supposed to start this summer. Giancarlo Sopo is one of the leaders of the program.
So much of Cuba discussion is focused around politics, right? And this gave me the opportunity to just kind of take politics out of the equation and just talk to people on a human level and listen to them and listen to their opinions on things. And you realize that the Cuban people have a lot also that they could offer to the rest of the world. And I thought that it was really important for my generation here to become acquainted with their peers on the island. So I've been working with an amazing team on putting this program together, and we're incredibly excited. I think it's important for people on both sides of the Florida Straits to talk to one another and have this healthy dialogue.
Yeah, I know that you and the co-founders of the Cuba One Foundation kind of saw the birthright trips to Israel as a model for the Cuba One project. What did you see in those Israel trips that you thought could be replicated and would be beneficial for young Cubans?
Yeah, so it was incredibly inspiring to see how my friends who have been on the Birthright Israel trip, that helped them form emotional connections to Israel and to Israelis, and how that helped foster ties between people in both countries on a people-to-people level. So we looked at that and we thought of ways that it could be applied to the Cuban-American community, obviously, which is very different than the experience that Jews in the United States have had. It's a different dynamic. But we thought of ways that it could be applied to our community. And we thought, especially with the openings since December 17th and some of the changes in Cuban laws, that there were now opportunities for us to engage the Cuban people on a very personal level and start building those relationships, which I think are important to both my community here in South Florida, but also it could be tremendously beneficial to the Cuban people.
Considering your family are not big fans of Castro, what do they think about this project?
It's funny. I think my mom has been kind of lukewarm about it. She respects what I'm doing, and she knows that it comes from a good place. She's someone who's actually, like, she's been back to Cuba very frequently, but she sees it more as a family necessity. Interestingly, my aunt, whose father, my grandfather, died in a Cuban prison, she's been very receptive and warm to it. You know, she was one of the first people who told me last year when I went to Cuba that she thought it was important for new generations who had nothing to do with the events of 1959 to start anew and to start building those relationships, because it's important for my generation not to have an adversarial relationship with our counterparts on the island. It's not productive. It doesn't accomplish anything.
So how are you funding this, and how do you pick which kids get to go to Cuba?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we feel incredibly passionate about this project. We call it, it's like a passion project for all of us. So we believe in the mission, and we've invested our own personal resources into this initiative, which gives us a budget of about $100,000 this year to take 40 young Cuban Americans to the island. And as far as next steps, we want to be able to grow this program. So we see this as a proof of concept, if you will, and we want to take this idea to donors and to funders, like foundations here in the United States, who can help us jumpstart this initiative and grow it, and hopefully take our belief is that we'd like to take our entire generation to Cuba to meet its peers. We think it's very important. So
that's a lot of people.
Yeah, that is a lot of people. So yeah, so we definitely want to expand the program, and we're going to think of creative ways where we could finance that and make it possible.
Giancarlo Sopo, one of the leaders of the Cuba One program, thanks very much for telling us about it.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Finally today, you know the notion that lightning never strikes twice in the same spot? Well, don't tell that to the people who live near Lake Maracaibo in Venezuela.
In a year, we have more than 100,000 lightning flashes there.
Yep, 100,000. That's Rachel Albrecht. She's one of the scientists who's been collecting data on lightning strikes around Lake Maracaibo. Albrecht explains Maracaibo is the lightning capital of the world.
Lake Maracaibo is a very large lake surrounded by mountains right in the end of the Andes Mountains in South America. These very warm waters makes what we call a convergence breezes. These breezes are like from the mountain towards the lake. This convergence of winds makes like 300 days with thunderstorms, very large thunderstorms over that same spot, that very large lake. So it's so often that the state of Zulia in Venezuela, where this lake is, it has a lightning bolt on its flag.
Wow.
They just get used it.
Right. And get used to it. It sounds like all you need is a lot of wind converging over a body of warm water, and you've got lightning. I'm not even sure in my own head how lightning happens.
Oh, lightning happens when we have clouds with very intense updrafts inside the cloud, like vertical winds. And we have on this, inside these thunderstorms, ice formation, like small ice particles. These ice particles, they collide with each other. And during each collision, they separate electrical charges. And this happens like millions of times inside the clouds and start building up pockets of charges inside the cloud. That's when lightning forms.
How do you actually collect data about lightning strikes?
On this study, we used the lightning imaging sensor on board of the TRIM satellite. TRIM stands for Tropical Rainfall Measuring Mission. It is a NASA's mission. It is an optical sensor, so we see optical emissions from light on the top of the clouds. We measure like a frame of data, like it would be an image every 2 milliseconds.
In your research, how close have you ever come to seeing a lightning strike?
Oh, it was in the Amazon in a field experiment. It was raining a lot. We were in two cars. I was on the car behind, and a lightning struck the car in front of us, right in front of us. That car kind of lit up in a bluish light when the lightning struck, and we were like so amazed. And
everybody was okay?
They didn't notice, actually, that they were hit by a lightning. Just us that saw it from behind.
Wow.
It was very scary.
Rachel Albrecht, an atmospheric scientist in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Thank you for telling us about all this lightning in Lake Maracaibo.
Okay, thank you.
And like lightning at Lake Maracaibo, the world strikes again tomorrow, right where you are. But we're done for today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a good one.
PRI, Public Radio International.